We could never quite remember who spotted it first. There we were, out in the middle of the lake, out in the middle of the night, in the moonlight, struggling on. We'd been rowing for hours into the teeth of the winds. We were still only halfway across, too tired to talk, too flat even to think about the amazing events of the day we'd just seen. Even James and John had stopped arguing. All we could hear was the wind keening and the choppy waves splashing against our bows. And then someone saw it. Rowing, of course, we were facing back the way we'd come. There it was. A misty figure moving towards us over the water, still several hundred yards away. I wanted to rub my eyes, but I didn't think I should let go of my oar. Tired as we were, this was no hallucination. We knew we could all see it. Came nearer. Now we could see it was striding across the waves. It wasn't heading straight for us. It seemed to be going past. But I can tell you the hairs on the back of my head were standing on end. That was when we gave up rowing. Couldn't do anything but stare. You know what we used to think about spirits of the night? Someone cried out, and then we were all yelling, "Help!" A bit daft, really, in the middle of a lake. But we were terrified. We didn't know what we were saying. And that's when he turned and came towards us. That's when we finally realized who it was. And he spoke to us. And it was all right. That's how Peter the disciple might have described this story to Mark 30 years later as they sat down together in Rome. Almost certainly it's Peter who passes on this story. Peter who was there in the boat. Peter who himself was mistaken by people for a ghost one day. Peter who experienced the amazing events of Jesus' earthly life firsthand. Last week's story was amazing enough. Remember what happened? Jesus has taken his tired group of followers away for a break, but when they get there, they find a crowd already waiting, a crowd who soon get very hungry. And the disciples don't have a clue how to handle this situation. All they can think of is to send the crowd away to somehow find food in the surrounding villages late in the evening. But Jesus takes the handful of food that is available. And he works a miracle. He makes that one packed lunch feed a crowd of many thousands. And the disciples who thought the situation was hopeless are the ones who serve the meal. And they're the ones who pick up the scraps. There is more left over than they started with. With that wonderful miracle, Jesus does more than feed a hungry crowd. When he looks at those people, he sees them as sheep without a shepherd, lost, aimless, wandering. And then as he makes them lie down in the green fields, and by feeding them and by caring for them, Jesus shows that he is the real shepherd. He is the good shepherd. He is the one who makes all the old promises come true. He is the one they need. It's hard to be sure how much the crowds know about what's going on. But as we move on to today's story, Mark gives us some clues. As soon as the miracle is over, we read this in verse 45. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowds. Clearly, Jesus does not want either the crowds or the disciples hanging around. The Galilean mob is notoriously excitable, and there's a real danger that they all get carried away with what's happened. If they have recognized Jesus as some kind of new Moses figure, and they would be right to do so, they will want to adopt him as their leader and quite possibly to start an uprising. Remember, this is occupied territory. This is an enslaved people, in fact. Politics here means rebellion. In fact, one of the other gospel accounts confirms that that is exactly what the crowd want to do. But Jesus will have none of it. It's a temptation he has to resist because he is not going to be that kind of leader. Yes, he has come to rescue his people, but not to rescue them from the Romans. He has an even greater goal than that. In fact, it's even possible that the reason Jesus gets rid of the disciples so quickly is that he doesn't want them stirring up the crowds by explaining how they saw Jesus multiplying the bread and fish. They're quite excited enough already. So he sends the 12 away in the boat they arrived in a few hours before and tells them to go back to the northern end of the Sea of Galilee, to Bethsaida. He will follow later on foot, as indeed he does, though not quite by the route they imagine. But meanwhile, once the crowd has finally dispersed peacefully, Jesus climbs up into the hills to pray. By the way, the location is probably very close to where he healed the demon-possessed man in chapter 5. And there he prays, as we see Jesus elsewhere, praying at night, perhaps the only time when he can find enough peace, coming once more to share time with his Father, no doubt to gather strength after the demands of the last few hours, to recommit himself to follow the hard road that lies ahead of him. His path is not to be through political uprising, however much the crowds would like to see that. No, his path leads to the cross, where he will complete the greatest rescue mission of all. Meanwhile, out on the lake, the going is also very tough. Jesus looks up and he can see them. They're in the middle of the lake, which would mean 3 or 4 miles away. But from a high hillside and assuming a full moon, it doesn't take supernatural sight to see the boat fighting its way against a strong headwind and the white caps on the waves. This isn't like the sudden violent squall we read about in chapter 4. This is the steady, hard grind of rowing hour after hour into the wind. By this time, the disciples are probably as exhausted as the crews at the end of the boat race. And so, about the fourth watch of the night, that's around 3 in the morning, Jesus comes to them. The account tells us quite simply, as if it's the most natural thing in the world, walking on the lake. What a shock that was for the disciples. They think they're seeing a ghost, not because they're superstitious, but just because there seems to be no other explanation. People don't walk on water, outside tabloid headlines anyway. But Jesus speaks. "Don't be afraid. It's me." He gets in, the wind drops, the disciples are amazed. Soon they're on their way again. They arrive not at Bethsaida in the very northern corner of the lake, but at Gennesaret in the northwest. Probably the wind has blown them off course. And having arrived and they still haven't had their break, guess what they see? Another crowd looming up in the grey dawn light. People already going about their business in these shoreline fishing villages. They recognized him when he left, back in verse 33, and now they recognize him when he comes back, verse 54. And the response is immediate. Very soon, the people are flocking from far and near, collecting everyone who can move or everyone they can carry to bring them near to Jesus and have him heal them. They've all heard the stories about how he healed the paralyzed man a mile or two up the coast at Capernaum. And there was that woman who just touched him, and she was healed instantly. They've heard the stories And so they come from miles around to do the same. Wherever Jesus goes, the eager crowds are there. And they know just exactly what they want from him. They want to be well again. And he gives them the healing they're looking for. Oh, it's another vivid eyewitness story. And from it, I want to look at three characters or groups of characters and see what they can tell us. First character is Jesus. And once again in this story, he has revealed himself in a new and powerful way. You see, just as the feeding of the 5,000 is about much more than filling people's stomachs, so this miracle of walking on the water is far more than Jesus proving he has an alternative to the boat. Once again, just like last week, this story has deep roots in the Old Testament. This time we look back to the book of Job and to this passage where Job praises God for his wisdom and power in creating the world. Job chapter 9. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He is the maker of the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades and the constellations of the south. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. When he passes me, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him. Do you get that? He alone, that is God alone, treads on the waves of the sea. And here is Jesus treading on the waves of the sea. What does that make Jesus? And here's our first clue to something in the story that's actually very puzzling. In verse 48, we read, he was about to pass by them. What's that about? Why ever would Jesus be heading to go past them if he's supposed to be coming to help? That Job passage is a hint. In the Old Testament, when people get a glimpse of the glory of God, it's often said that he passes by. When God appears to Moses at Mount Sinai, we read that he passed in front of Moses. Later, when the prophet Elijah meets with God in the same place, God tells Elijah, go and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Out on the lake, Jesus is doing what God does, passing by in his power and glory. And in this story, we see the Lord Jesus as the majestic creator, the Lord Jesus who is God himself, who can tread on the waters of the sea because he has made them. They belong to him and they obey his commands. If walking on the water breaks the laws of physics, which of course it does, that's not a problem for the one who devised those laws before the universe was made. And yet that's not the most amazing thing about Jesus in this story. Because although he is God, although he is all-powerful and far beyond us, who can bestride the waves, he is also the man who gets into the boat. When the frightened disciples cry out, he comes to them and he says, don't worry, it's me. Their friend is back. And he gets in the boat. I don't know if he takes an oar, gives them a hand with the rowing, but he could have. In that other miracle, in chapter 4, where Jesus stills the storm, he stands up in the boat and he tells the winds and waves to shut up. And they do. Here, it's a little different. Verse 51, he climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down. As if Jesus brings peace with him. So that once he arrives, once he joins his followers in the boat, it is simply impossible for the wind to keep blowing. It just drops. When Jesus arrives, calm descends and all is peace. Jesus, the God-man. God who was there before creation. God who was there right through creation. but also the man who brings peace to his people. Have you seen that? Do you know him? But now let's look at the disciples. They've been struggling to row across the lake. Jesus arrives, walking on the water, and they're terrified. Let's pick up verses 51, 52. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Now, of course, the disciples know that a miracle has happened with the loaves when Jesus fed the crowds. They saw it with their own eyes. But for all that, they don't understand. They don't get the point about who Jesus really is. Mark tells us their hearts were hardened. They don't have that spiritual openness to grasp the real Jesus and trust him. In fact, they don't understand Jesus much better than his enemies do at this point. But they should understand. They've spent so much time with him, seen him do so much, but they still don't get it. What should they be able to see? They should see that if Jesus can make one bread roll feed 1,000 people, there is in fact no limit to what he can do. They should see that if he cares enough to feed a whole crowd of strangers, he's hardly likely to abandon his best friends. Isn't that obvious? But this kind of hardness isn't about your brains. It's not about your intelligence. It's about faith. It's about believing, putting all your trust, all your reliance, all your hopes into Jesus. And the disciples still haven't got there. Have you? And the disciples should understand what living with Jesus is about. If you want a good picture of the Christian life, here it is in this story. You get into trouble, you struggle, you cry for help, and Jesus comes to your rescue. And then pretty soon it happens again. It's a constant pattern of trial and deliverance, trial and deliverance. Trials and difficulties are perfectly normal in the Christian life. You see here, the disciples are in difficulty not because they've done anything wrong. They've done just exactly what Jesus has told them to do. Row back across the lake. They're not in trouble because they've gone wrong. They're in trouble because that's what happens. The path of obeying Christ lies through trials and difficulties. As Jesus says to his disciples later, "In this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world." Perhaps one of the simplest but most important lessons a Christian has to learn. And if you're not a Christian yet, and you're thinking about giving your life to Christ, here's the health warning. Don't think being a Christian is plain sailing. It's not. And in this church, we will never tell you that. All too often, it's more like rowing into a strong headwind. It's through these struggles that our faith is built up. This is how we learn to trust in the Lord for everything. You don't learn that when everything's going swimmingly. You learn it when it's tough. Or you should. All too often we're like the disciples. We don't learn what we should learn. You know the story of the man who owned a very stupid dog? This dog was always running out into the roads wherever it went, and the neighbours got used to hearing the squeal of brakes as drivers took desperate avoiding action. But the stupid dog didn't learn, kept running out into the road until one day at a particular point it ran out once too often and a car sent it flying. Well, the dog was patched up, it was okay. Had it learned its lesson? No. Went straight back to its old ways. It would run into the road everywhere. Except at that one point, All it had learnt was to be terrified of that one bit of road. You know, I think we are like that dog. We are incredibly slow to learn. I want to challenge you Christians and myself as well. Think back to a past trial that you went through, a time that was really hard. Not some mess you got yourself into, but a time when simply living a faithful Christian life took you into trouble. At home, college, work, or in a relationship. Can you remember a time like that? There are people here, many of you, who have been through more trials than I have known. But what did you do? Did you pray? Of course you did. Did the Lord answer you and bring you through, perhaps not at once, but in his own time? Now, can we recall what we learned from that time? Did we learn about God being faithful? Did we learn that he answers prayer? And did we remember that the next time? Do we remember it now? Trials come to make us grow, to make us more like Jesus. There is no trial so deep that the Lord cannot use it to make you more like Jesus. Do you know that? So that the next time we're straining at the oars, we won't panic. We will trust, because the Lord Jesus will bring us his peace. So much for the disciples. Now, finally, what about the crowd? The crowd Jesus meets when he gets out of the boat at Gennesaret. They ran throughout that whole region and carried the sick on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, into villages, towns, or countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak, and all who touched him were healed. This frantic, desperate crowd. What do they want? They want healing. We should try and understand how desperate people must have been in days when there were no hospitals and only the most rudimentary medicine. There were no benefits if you were disabled. If you couldn't work, you had to beg or simply hope that your family would do the right thing for you and take care of you. Of course, if you heard that there was someone near who could heal you, you'd do everything in your power to get near. Hear their desperation. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak. We don't hear anything about Jesus doing any teaching, picking up his teaching ministry again here. There's no mention of that. These people aren't ready for that. They see Jesus as some kind of wandering healer, possessed by some divine power that's communicated by touch. They understand even less than the disciples do. And yet the wonderful truth here is that Jesus accepts them with their limited understanding. He doesn't turn them away, and all who touched him were healed. Of course they need to know more. Of course they too need to recognize Jesus' true identity. The time will come for that. But you don't need to know everything before you come to him. He just wants you to come. So where are you with Jesus? This is no hallucination. This is no dream of the night. If you know the Lord Jesus already, if you do know him, are you learning what it means to live with him? To trust him completely, even when you are battling with the storm. Some of you are in the middle of the storm right now. Not because you've turned away from him, but simply because he has led you that way. And he does. Will you trust him with your trial? With your storm? And what if you don't know him? This story actually paints a picture of what the Lord Jesus has done for us, you know. It tells the story of his love for us. At the beginning of this story, there he is, on high, on the mountain, as it were, enjoying the unity and the fellowship which he has with God the Father. And he looks down and he sees humanity in trouble. He sees us unable to help ourselves. And so he does not remain up there where it's quiet and peaceful and safe. Instead, he comes down here. He crosses over into our space and time, and he becomes a man. He shares our humanity, our flesh and blood, and he gets into the boat with us. The creator of the universe enters into our very lives. And where Jesus comes, there is peace. Do you know this Jesus yet? The man who is God, the Jesus who chose to come into this pain-filled, sin-sick, screwed-up world and go the hardest path, all the way to the cross, where he bought peace for us at the cost of his own blood. Has this become real to you? Have you seen it? Are you at the point where you will turn away from your past life and let Jesus take over? He's waiting to do it.